So I hope this will be interesting, if it's not what you came for. I'm Teresa Betancourt. I'm a faculty member at the Harvard School of Public Health and Global Health and Population. And I also direct a research program on children and global adversity at the FXB Center for Health and Human Rights. And I'm going to be taking a little different spin on talking about populations and adversity and talk about our research on protective processes and resilience in Rwanda and children and families affected by HIV and AIDS. And this is also set in the context of post-genocide Rwanda. Let's see if I can get this to work. I have no relationships to disclose. So I'm going to talk a little bit about background on Rwanda and then discuss with you some of the challenges we face in measuring cross-cultural constructs, especially related to mental health and resilience, and present to you our approach, which is a mixed methods approach, which uses qualitative and quantitative methods. I'll share with you some of our data from Rwanda and then how we're using this in intervention development as well as the design of appropriate measures. I have to acknowledge that this is not just my work, but it's the work of a large team of collaborators, particularly at Partners in Health in Rwanda, the Rwandan government, and our funding support from a number of different supporters. And we're really honored that this work recently has been elected for NIH support, so we're very excited about that. So I'm talking about this area of Rwanda, Rinkwavu, which is in the east, bordering Burundi and Tanzania. It's about 2 hours from Kigali. To give you some background on Rwanda, as you know, it's a very teeny country with a very high population density, over 10 million inhabitants. The population is estimated to double in size by 2030. And like a lot of sub-Saharan Africa, we have a youth bulge with 42% less than the age of 14. So when we're talking about children, adolescents, and family, we're really talking about a very important target population. Prevalence of HIV in the country was 11% in 2001. It's currently 3%, particularly due to a lot of tremendous leadership in health systems by the Rwandan government and partner organizations like Partners in Health. But at the same time, Rwanda has one of the highest rates of orphanhood in all of Africa. By 2007, an estimated 220,000 children had lost one or both parents to AIDS, and that's about 43% of all orphans in the country. And Rwanda is really an instance of compounded adversity. You have the overlay of the after effects of the genocide, and then the HIV epidemic layered on top of that, and it's hit families very hard, particularly in these poor rural areas like where our study is based. Now, Partners in Health is very cognizant of the role of mental health and overall health and the need to improve services, but we needed a lot more information on exactly the shape of mental health problems facing children, particularly children affected by HIV and family dynamics, and we were very interested in building on strengths, so we were also needing to understand more about protective processes operating in individuals, families, and communities in order to develop services. Now, just to give you some background on what we know about adversity and mental health in Rwanda, certainly there's been a lot of research since the genocide. We know that children who lost caregivers due to the genocide had increased risk of mental health problems, particularly depression and PTSD. And that we've seen with the overlay of the genocide and the HIV/AIDS issues affecting families, that there have been ways in which there are dramatic shifts happening in families, that responsibilities that would normally be a parental responsibility are being shifted to children in the family, that the social network, that the sort of social fabric of life that supported child rearing has really been damaged by the genocide and also by issues like stigma. And in terms of children in these roles of responsibility, we've seen other studies of youth-headed households, which are very common in Rwanda, also showing very high rates of depression, social isolation, emotional distress. And then all of this is set in the context of extreme adversity due to economic factors. And so all of this poses a picture of risk for many families, particularly when HIV is affecting the family. But when we talk about HIV, we really have to think of it as a family illness. It's not just about the HIV-positive person, but it's about the cascading effects that it has on the family. So in HIV-affected families, there may be a lot of miscommunication, family conflict, blame, misunderstanding, misinformation about HIV and how you can get it. We've certainly worked with families where the children ran away from home once they heard their parents were HIV-positive, thinking if they touched them or shared their food that they would get HIV. And also also we have to think about everyone in the family and the way in which the illness is affecting them, and sometimes you have multiple people affected. So the real question is, how can we reduce risk of mental health problems in children and caregivers affected by HIV/AIDS as they're coming into contact with care systems and getting ART treatment? What can we do about those family dynamics, parenting, and mental health issues, which we know are also threatened by the context of HIV in the family? And in particular, you want to learn about building on locally relevant resources at the individual, the family, and the community level. So how do we learn about that? Well, one big barrier is this reality of how do you study these things in cultures that you don't know a lot about, you don't speak the language. This is a quote from Arthur Kleinman, who's a very well-known anthropologist and psychiatrist. He says, we know from ethnography that concepts of emotions, the self and body, and general illness categories differ so significantly in different cultures that it can be said that each culture's belief about normal and abnormal behavior are distinctive. So with that as the backdrop, what do we normally do when we go out to assess mental health problems? Well, the standard approach often looks like this. We may select or create a questionnaire, often from a standard measure, maybe a standard measure of depression, that's developed outside the local context. We may translate that to the local language, but often without the time and resources to test the validity of that measure. Conduct interviews based on that adapted questionnaire, determine the need based on the frequency of responses, choose your problem to focus on based on a quantitative result, and then we may repeat these surveys before or after intervention to look at effectiveness. Now, it's an approach that's used a lot. It's one I've used myself in different settings, but there's some real problems with it. And the first problem is the issue of cultural validity. So how well do concepts from a standard measure developed outside that culture really fit what's important locally? Then you have the other issue of unknown local concepts. So this is the question, how do you even ask the questions you don't know you should be asking? So there may be very relevant indicators of psychopathology, relevant indicators of protective processes that we don't know to ask, especially if we start with an outside measure and we've just brought it into a new context. And then you have the issue of translation problems. So just by nature of speaking the local language and English, a lot of the people we hire to do translation or interpretation services come from a very different background in life, very different word usage. And that may not be very representative of the vulnerable populations we're trying to assist in our services. And so the risk of all this is that we may be missing information when we go to evaluate programs, that we have a lot of error in our measurement, and we may be missing the boat entirely when it comes to things like protective processes. So what we propose to address this challenge is to use more of a mixed methods approach. So to combine qualitative and quantitative methods together to get at better assessment of what matters, and then to use this in adapting measures as well as interventions. So this is a model that sort of guides work I'm doing under a career development award from the NIMH. And in the first step of the model, we are identifying important mental health constructs through qualitative inquiry. And this means both the mental health problems of importance to a population that you're targeting, as well as the protective processes. So not only what are the mental health problems that can be expected, how do people think about them, but also what are the things that matter to mitigate some of these risks, and to learn about that from the ground up. And then to use that information now to come to the selection of measures, if you can find good comparability between what you've learned about from the ground up and standard measures, by all means use them. In some cases, you may have to make your own measure if you find that the construct you're trying to capture is not well represented by what's out there, but now you've got qualitative data to base it on. And this is also an opportunity, now that you've learned about what are the issues and what are some of the mitigating factors and protective processes, to look at intervention models that fit the cultural context. So if you've learned about what people do to help each other and want to consider different models, do you use a group-based model, do you an individual treatment because there are issues around stigma and communication, this is really time to think about how the intervention can fit culturally too. And now, having adapted your measures, it's very important to validate your measures if at all possible, and there are many forms of validity. You know, you've got face validity, concurrent validity, construct validity, at least to begin to attend to some of those issues. And then we come back in the third step and implement the culturally informed intervention and assess it with your adapted culturally informed measures using the most rigorous designs possible. And we've used models like this even to the level of conducting randomized control trials in different war-affected settings. So I'm going to show you data that came from using two main qualitative methods. There are many more qualitative methods out there. But here, because we wanted to learn in a rapid way about the terminology that was important, we used first free listing and then key informant interviews. Now in free list, you're asking a very simple question, like a grand tour question we call it, that'll give you answers in the form of a list. We're talking about mental health, but we find that doesn't get translated very well when we work with interpreters. And so something that is sort of commonly understood is the term problems. So we may ask something like, what are the problems of children around here? And we get these lists of different issues, everything from poverty, hunger, to the children are worried, they've lost hope. And it's when we begin to see those, because we're interested in mental health, there are a lot of other programs going for the other issues. We then probe further on those terms in the local language to draw out the words that relate to thinking, feeling, relationships. And then we take those to key informant interviews. Once we have these clusters of terms, we begin to talk to people about, for a child who has these sorts of problems, is there a term for that? And then once we learn those cover terms, we begin to pull those out, and what are the indicators of those cover terms? And you can do this method both for protective constructs as well as mental health related constructs. And if you're interested, we have a few papers that describe these methods in more detail. So I'm going to now move into some of our findings. The first study was investigating mental health syndromes that were common in HIV-affected children. Does anyone here speak Kinyarwanda? Because I will now butcher the Kinyarwanda language, and I apologize in advance. But some of the findings of common mental health syndromes in children included the problem of agahinda kenshi, or persistent sadness or sorrow, kuiheba, hopelessness characterized often by suicidality, guhanga yika, a problem of constant worry, umushiha, persistent irritability and anger. And this is very interesting in the context of HIV, because people talked about it as children encounter stigma due to HIV, that anger they feel and the irritability, they begin to almost hold it inside themselves, and they interact with the world in a very angry way. And you don't find that very easily in the DSM. And then uburara, undisciplined or bad behavior, but very much shaped by the Rwandan context. So you don't see the kind of items that you'd expect to see in the West, because you're breaking social norms now in Rwanda. And then ihahamuka, which is a term that relates to trauma. And they talked about trauma related both to the genocide, but it's less relevant to kids today, but also that it could describe trauma related to finding out about someone's HIV positive status, including family members. Now on the flip side, we had these words for mental health problems, we understood a lot of the ways in which they were described, but we didn't know a lot about what could help and what could help offset the risk of these mental health problems. So we went back and did a second qualitative study asking about what are the things about individuals, about families, about communities that help them to do well despite adversity, despite hard times? What are the factors that can help offset the risk of these sorts of mental health problems in children and families? And what we learned about were five main protective processes. The first one is kuigiriri ikizere, self-esteem or self-acceptance, kuihangana, coping or perseverance in the family, kuizarana, a sense of family unity and togetherness, and I'm going to show you some of the indicators of these, and then uburara buiza, good parenting, and ubufasha, our social support. And you see ways in which these map on almost to an ecological level. You've got factors of the individual, factors at the family level, and then more societal or community-related factors. And just to give you some descriptives on how this looks in the Rwandan context, here's kuigiriri ikizere, self-esteem or confidence. So a child who's exhibiting this thinks about their future, feels that life will continue no matter what. They feel strong at heart. They're not fearful. They feel they can do many things. They feel they have no problems. They have a religious belief. They enjoy the company of others, and they take care of their health. Kuihangana, sense of coping or perseverance. Children exhibiting this interact well with others. They don't lose hope. They play well with others, with their peers. They're well-behaved. They're characterized by goodness. They don't isolate. They pray. They accept help and advice, work hard despite personal problems, and remain calm under pressure. And then this is the Kuizarana family togetherness. And when you think about some of the threats due to family functioning in the context of HIV that I talked about earlier, you can see how important factors like this are in thinking of program models. So Kuizarana is described as Families who exhibit this have good communication. They talk to one another. They talk to reach agreement. They live together in harmony. They're unified in their thought. They're unified as a family. They work together towards common goals. They don't hide things from one another. They share joy amongst each other. They respect each other. They're characterized by love. They don't have conflict. They interact. They share secrets, but they also keep secrets that shouldn't be shared outside the family. They're honest to one another. They don't lie. The parents don't cheat on one another. So you see all these issues, you know, that relate to the ways in which family breakdown can happen in the context of HIV. So something like this, as we see, these are protective processes that we really want to attend to in thinking of how we can help families function and still do well despite HIV. This is the indicator of good parenting. So a parent exhibiting good parenting is teaching their children discipline. They're training them, providing them with teachings about life, providing their basic needs, but also expressing or showing love, which you can imagine all these things become quite difficult when a parent is impaired due to illness, is distracted by seeking medical care, is having to attend to economic needs. They're close to children. They provide advice. They converse with them. They respect them. They interact. They listen to children. The parents are happy. They treat all children equally. And then you see some very unique sort of Rwandan items like parenting for the country, parenting for the nation, which is this view that you parent all children as if they were your own, that Rwanda is again this larger family that you're committed to as a parent that you contribute to. And then this is the last one, Ubufasha, talking about collective support at the community level. This is exhibited when people are close to one another. They don't discriminate, so you can see how stigma can come in to affect this. They reassure one another. Visiting is very important in the Rwandan culture, so you would spend a lot of your downtime going to be with friends or family and visiting. That's a very important expression of support. Providing help as you're able, taking care of those who are sick, communicating, helping people get out of isolation, despair, providing advice and basic needs as they are needed. So now with these protective processes, we could look at intervention models that could help strengthen these and build on these resources that we know exist in individuals and families and communities in Rwanda. And so this is the development of what we call the Family Strengthening Intervention for Rwanda. When we first went about choosing an intervention, we conducted a review of the literature, and we were very drawn to the work of Dr. William Beardsley, who's a psychiatrist at Children's Hospital. And he had developed what's called the family-based preventative intervention, which is an evidence-based practice. It's in the National Registry of Effective Programs and Practices. And it was originally developed to prevent depression in the offspring of depressed caregivers. We know that that's one of the greatest risk factors for depression as children, is having a depressed caregiver. It was designed to be administered by a wide range of providers. It takes a family-based approach. It focuses on enhancing resilience and communication in families affected by depression. And so you've got this context of parenting in the face of a chronic illness and understanding the family dynamics related to that. And we saw this as really an interesting fit to the context of Rwanda and to what we had learned about family functioning and also protective resources around unity, around communication, around helping families navigate that. So this is the first time there's been an effort to adapt this to sub-Saharan Africa and also to the context of HIV. So how are we doing this adaptation? Well, we've established 4 community advisory boards. So we have an advisory board of parents, of community members, of young people, and then of clinicians who work with HIV-affected families. And that's been tremendous because we can have communications really about what's appropriate culturally and really have debates in those groups and get good information. And one of my favorite things was to sit with that youth group and talk with them about alternatives to corporal punishment, and just hear how wise young people are and children are about good examples and healthy examples to help parents also think, you know, in the Rwandan cultural context, things that they've seen done or, you know, that they're pretty high-functioning kids that their parents do to help them. This is also a collaboration between the Ministry of Health and Partners in Health, and with the community advisory boards has very strong local input. And it's taking a strengths-based approach, trying to build on those protective resources I described as the active ingredients of the intervention to help offset risks. We're developing a manualized protocol, and in this, through the community advisory board process, also integrating a great deal of cultural content through songs, through proverbs. There's a long tradition of transmitting information through the telling of proverbs in families in Rwanda. We try to capture those sort of core messages through songs, proverbs, role play to help communicate core ideas, because this is often very low literacy families that we're working with, but everyone knows more of the traditional tales or proverbs or sayings, so that's very helpful for grounding the material. So this is also our conceptual model. I talked with earlier about some of the risk factors that operate in HIV-affected families, misinformation about HIV and AIDS, foreshortened sense of the future, poor communication amongst family members, and then family social and economic stress, including conflict. And so the core components there of the intervention are psychoed about HIV and AIDS, and also about trauma, because we recognize that a lot of these parents are genocide survivors, and sometimes there are ways in which their decision-making and their fears about raising their children and their relationships with the community are also set in the context of loss and trauma due to the genocide, so we can't ignore that. Another core component of the Beardsley intervention is the family narrative. And this is very interesting when you get back to the Rwandan tradition of telling stories and the story of the family, that a big part of the intervention is helping the parents tell the story of the family and the story of the HIV in the family, and then also from the children's perspective, understanding that and their experience of HIV in the family and how it's affected the different relationships and different members of the family, and helping the family to reflect as they tell that narrative on the sources of strength that they have exhibited over time, and helping them to really understand and own and recognize the resilience that they've demonstrated as a family throughout many things. And if you think that these are caregivers who survived the genocide, that they've really drawn on a lot of resources to be where they are today, and we have to honor that in the intervention and help people to reconnect with those resources as they move forward in the face of HIV. Also improving family communication and supporting better parenting skills, and then helping them to navigate the environment better, so outlining problem-solving skills and helping them to think about connecting with both non-formal resources, so we saw the Ubu Fascia, the collective support, and also formal programs that the government has established and that groups like Partners in Health operate in the community. And so that's a big part of the problem-solving exercise, with the goal being to reduce risk of mental health problems in children and improve parent-child relationships. These are just some slides of our intervention modules. Here's a role play about a boy whose mother has HIV and how he struggled with stigma in the community. And then these are illustrations talking about core concepts such as Kwizerana, or family togetherness. And I mentioned just a bit the flow of the modules, but we spend time first with the caregivers establishing the family narrative and the story and identifying the different protective processes that have helped the family and helping them to think about the overall picture of how HIV has affected the family dynamic and their children. And then we have similar sessions with the children divided by age, so with the older kids and then the younger kids, because developmentally that's a very different conversation. And then we prepare both groups for family meeting, and sort of the culmination of the intervention is this family meeting and beginning to move towards shared family goals. And then we do a follow-up session. So it's really meant to be brief, and it's meant to integrate with the package of care that HIV-affected families are getting. So our next steps are to complete the manual in English and Kinyarwanda, and we've had tremendous feedback from those community advisory boards and the social work team, and then to conduct a pilot feasibility study of the family strengthening intervention. And the first time we do this, we're going to do it with more seasoned social workers, just because we recognize for safety, feasibility to test, you know, can we do this? Does it go well? We want to do it with people who are more experienced. But the idea is eventually to have this at the level that community health workers could do it. And that's a big part of the health services system in Rwanda. And what we'd like to do in a future trial is to examine is can we be as effective with community health workers as with more seasoned social workers? And the end point of all this is having an evidence-based intervention that can be integrated within the standard package of care. So as families come into contact with care systems and they're getting antiretroviral treatment, but we also, social workers identify that family conflict and parent-child relationships are an issue, that this could be a complementary activity for some families, not all families, but those who need it. And with it being brief and relatively low cost and eventually being able to be done by community health workers, that we could see the possibility of scaling this up in different parts of the country within the health services system and also adapted to other forms of adversity. So that's the intention, and we're well on our way. So with that, I'll close, and thank you very much.